This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all Have Another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, HRRN Nation, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is indeed Trainer Talk, presented by Basic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna with you once again in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, extending a very special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM Channel 206. And for those of you tuning in on our website, on your smartphone or your tablet with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net, welcome to the program. You know, one of the great things about this show is that I not only get to visit with the current trainers who are actively involved with making an impact on our sport every day, but I also have the privilege to talk with trainers who have helped make our sport what it is today. Trainers who have become ingrained in the lore, the legend, the mystique of the sport of thoroughbred racing. And I realize that Throwback Thursday is officially tomorrow, but tonight I'm going to roll back the clock for the next hour, and we're going to take you on a little trip down memory lane through the eyes of Hall of Fame trainer John Veach. John, of course, was born in the heart of horse country in Lexington, Kentucky. And as the son of a Hall of Fame trainer, Sylvester Veach, you might say he was destined to become a part of this sport. During his training career, John saddled 410 winners with purse earnings of more than $20 million. He trained four champions, Our Mims, Devona Dale, Before Dawn, and Sunshine Forever, and he may be best known as the trainer of Alidar, runner-up in all three legs of the 1978 Triple Crown behind the great Affirmed. John is here with us tonight on Trainer Talk, presented by Basic Tipton. And John, welcome to the program. Very happy to have you on board, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I was going through that roster of all of your winners and a brief resume, and I'm afraid I probably left so many things out, and I can't wait to visit with you for the next hour.
I'm looking forward to it, Mike.
You know, when you Google John Veach biographies, you come up with a Scottish poet from the 1800s and a Scottish-born horticulturist from that same era. Curious, John, did you ever consider doing anything other than being involved with horse racing?
No, Mike, I really didn't. You know, I was born into it, and my father was very successful, and he was a great horseman. And I was raised in an era where, you know, horse trainers were very, very well respected, and it was a dream of mine always. And I had every benefit, I guess you could say, much more than most people, in being around and being raised by my father here in Kentucky, and spent my childhood at Belmont Park during the summers, and got to rub shoulders more or less with some of the great trainers of my father's era and before, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful life.
Your dad was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1977. Exactly 30 years later, you received that very same honor, John. Tell me about seeing your plaque along with your dad's in the Hall of Fame.
Well, I can remember, Mike, that probably the proudest moment of my life was the day that I witnessed my father being inducted into the Hall of Fame, knowing what it meant to him and how important the sport had been to not only to him but his brothers, and also to his father, who was a great steeplechase rider at the turn of the century. It was just a heart-rending experience, and certainly much more thrilling to me than my own induction.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I was going to ask you what you remembered about that day that your dad was inducted. How about the day that he received the phone call that he was going to get in, John? Do you remember that day?
The day that my father was going to get in?
Yeah.
Or
yeah, the day your dad was going to get in.
Yeah, I do, because he called me up, and he basically... my father was not an emotional man from the standpoint of he took wins and losses in the same way. But he was overwhelmed, is the best word for his feelings on being remembered with all of the other great trainers that had come before him and certainly all the other great jockeys and horses that are members of the Hall.
How about the day that you got the call, John? What was that day like?
Oh, well, it was exhilarating. I was at the end of my career and it was the beginning of the mega trainers and I'm certainly not going to take anything away from those fellows that are the mega trainers and they work very hard and they do jobs that would have overwhelmed me. But I felt that, you know, that it probably at the highlight of my career, the top of my career, I would have 24 or 26 horses at the beginning of the year to train. And at the end of the year, through attrition and horses that just didn't fit, you know, would be down to maybe a dozen and would start all over the next year. So I'd never had the numbers would qualify a lot of trainers to get into the Hall of Fame. But certainly I was very fortunate to have was given some very talented horses to train that overwhelmed me.
Yeah, the game is completely different today than it was when you started, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's totally different, and it was totally different than in my era of my father and his brothers, in the respect that it's now a game of numbers rather than a game of precise quality and precision.
Do you ever take the time to walk through the Hall of Fame or just sit and reflect upon everything that you and your dad and your entire family, for that matter, have accomplished?
Oh, sure. And many of the names, not only of that of my father and certainly of Elliot Birch, who I served my apprenticeship under or part of my apprenticeship under, but I mean men like Mr. Fitzsimmons and Eddie Neloy and John Gaver, who I knew personally. And as a little boy, I can remember leaving the paddock at Belmont Park with my father, and I probably was, maybe 6 or 7 years old, and Mr. Fitzsimmons is sitting on a bench there by the jockey's room as we walked out, and he handed me a Hershey chocolate bar, and he said, "We beat you today." And I, you know, just little things like that. And as a boy growing up, I spent, as I said earlier, a lot of my time, a lot of my summers, almost all of them, at Belmont Park, where my father was training privately for C.V. Whitney, and we had a cottage and lived right on the grounds. And I would, you know, I would see people and meet people. And in those days, we never had racing on Sunday. And my father would always have a brunch late in the morning, around 11 or 12, after everybody was done training. And all of the trainers of that era would stop by and have a drink and have cold cuts and talk horses and sit around all afternoon. It was just a wonderful experience for a young boy that, you know, had his sights set on doing that.
That is one of the most fascinating aspects of thoroughbred racing and our business, in my opinion, John, is the fact that you can have somebody like yourself at that point. Maybe you were 6 years old and you weren't John Veitch, quote unquote, at that point, but you're a young kid, you're aspiring to maybe do this someday. And I find that every single day in our sport, that people that are already successful will go out of their way to make time to talk with you. And it's the same thing that we see, for example, with a guy like Bill Farish, who may be standing at the rail watching one of his horses, and he's talking with a groom that handles that horse, and he's relying on the groom to give him information on this million-dollar horse that he has on the track. It is so fascinating about this sport, and one of the true good things about our sport, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. You know, and Mike, I can't tell you the number of things that I learned, some great experiences as a young boy and as a young man, and being around my father, but also being around many of the grooms and the exercise boys and the foremen that worked for my father that I would watch and listen to, and the pride that they took in what they did and the. Basically, just the overwhelming joy they had when they were associated with a good horse, and certainly with a major racing stable. I can remember in those days that at the C.B. Whitney farm, we would have men waiting years working at the farm just to be able to join the racing stable as it traveled to New York out of Kentucky or to Florida out of Kentucky. That had dedicated their lives to being part of the team. And, you know, in these days and in these modern days, you hear the word team work, you know, and that everybody's part of a team. Well, in those days, it was a real team in the respect that it was from birth to death, almost, that those people were associated with that farm and with that racing stable. It was like when I was fortunate enough to start and train for the Calumet farm, the old Calumet farm under Lucille Markey and the Admiral, that all the people at that farm, the huge number of people at that farm that had worked their entire lives there, and they were so steeped in this tradition of the Calumet farm and in racing that it was just an honor to be around them.
Talking with Hall of Famer John Veach on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John, what's it like growing up with your dad being Sylvester Veach?
It was a wonderful experience. It gave me such an appreciation for what this game is all about. Not only the people and the horses, but just the entire physical feeling of being part of a wonderful sport, a wonderful game, something that was so steeped in tradition that goes back centuries, and the people that have been involved with it, and the wonderful people that my father had the privilege of working for, C.V. Whitney as his private trainer, George D. Widener, who was chairman of the American Jockey Club, is his trainer, his last trainer. I will tell you that Mr. Widener, and probably 65 years or 70 years involved in the sport, and certainly becoming chairman of the American Jockey Club, which was a huge honor. He only had three trainers in his entire career as an owner.
Wow.
Mr. Jack Joyner, Hall of Fame trainer. Mr. Burt Mulholland, Hall of Fame trainer. Sylvester Veach, Hall of Fame trainer.
Wow. That's remarkable. That's absolutely incredible. And that speaks volumes as to your dad and the respect that he commanded from people and everything that he was able to accomplish. I know I was very close to my father as well. What's the number one lesson that your dad taught you that you've never forgotten, John?
Patience.
How so?
Well, you know, the thing about, particularly when you're dealing with a horse of exceptional ability, you sometimes get a little anxious. And the one thing about a very good horse, not only his character and his courage, but they will give you everything that they have inside of them all the time. And if you have not prepared them properly, particularly their developing training to get them up to the races, they're so easily ruined. And he said, you've got to be patient. You've got to think about the horse's well-being, and that you're going to do everybody well. You're going to do yourself well, you're going to do the horse well, you're going to do the owner well, and also you're going to do the fans well.
Now, your dad preferred training fillies. He had a great quote where he said that colts are like boys, more bullheaded, fillies are more apt pupils. I thought it was a great quote. Did you have a preference?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I did have my share of very good fillies, and of my champions, the majority were fillies, and as my father's were. My father was fortunate enough to have a great horse called Counterpoint, who was Horse of the Year in 1951 as a three-year-old. But he had some wonderful fillies, beginning with a filly by the name of First Flight, actually the first year that he was Mr. Whitney's private trainer, that was a brilliant filly and basically beat the colts in the two-year-old futurity race at Belmont Park, which was then the premier two-year-old race, colts and fillies, in the country. The thing about it is that I never felt that there was a lot of difference in training a colt or a filly. From a standpoint of gender, I did feel that sometimes there was a great deal of difference in training a horse, either colt or filly, from a standpoint of their inclination and their athletic ability and what it took for them to keep that competitive edge over an extended period of time. But really, I mean, you start off with the same fundamentals, I think.
Now, as you're growing up, you're working with your dad. You mentioned fellow Hall of Famer Elliot Birch, who you had the opportunity to work with for a little while, and I want to talk about that in a moment. But I also found it interesting that you played a little football when you were growing up, didn't you?
Yes, I did in high school and in college. I was mediocre in both dimensions.
A better trainer than a football player?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, now you went to school in Peoria, Illinois, right? Bradley University?
Bradley University, yes.
Okay, and fullback was your position, is that right?
Well, actually, they called me a halfback. I relied on speed and ignorance, I guess is a better word. I was very small and very light, but very fast.
Did you play all 4 years?
No, I didn't. I played 3 years.
Okay. Do you have a most memorable game?
No, I really don't. I guess the most memorable game, we played the University of Omaha, and I think I got knocked out twice. And I think that is my fondest memory.
What did you study?
I was studied history. I was a history major.
Wow. So did you always, even when you were in college, did you always have your sights set on getting back to the racetrack?
Yes. Oh, yes. My father was very influential in me continuing, particularly with a higher education, because he said that, you know, that if you choose my vocation, you're going to be dealing with a lot of very educated people, and it's good to have something to fall back on from a standpoint of learning. And he was, unfortunately, his father, Silas Veach, as I said earlier, was a very, very well-known and respected steeplechase jockey and trainer. And unfortunately, at the old Havre Grass Racetrack in the mid-20s, 1920s, he was schooling a jumper, which he probably was too old to be doing, and the horse fell with him, and he expired eventually from those injuries. And my father was in high school at the time, and basically had to quit school and go to work. And but he valued an education.
So after you left college, did you then go to work for Elliot Birch, or were you already associated with him?
Basically, I went to work. My father was the private trainer for George Widener in those days, and I went to work for my father as his first assistant.
Okay.
And then Elliot approached my father and asked my father if he had any reservations about me being offered a job working for Mr. Paul Mellon through B Stable. And my father thought it was a great opportunity, mainly because all trainers do things a little bit different. And it's good to get as much exposure as you possibly can to somebody else's methods and practices. And he thought it would be a great learning experience for me. And it did work out exceptionally well.
What was so much different about Elliot's approach as opposed to your dad's?
I think that the main approach was that Elliot didn't want to have a lot to do with the younger horses, particularly in their yearling breaking phases and things like that, where my father felt it was a great part of his insight into a horse's future if he could be kind of a hands-on person from the very beginning. I think he got that because he worked for C.B. Whitney as his farm manager here in Lexington and was in charge of the horse division, and that gave him a great insight into the horses when he became Mr. Whitney's head trainer in 1946.
Now, you were only about 13 years old when Elliot first got rolling with Horse of the Year Sword Dancer in 1959, but I know you were plenty old enough to remember 1969 Horse of the Year Arts and Letters.
I came in and worked for Elliot at the very end of Arts and Letters' career and was there for Key to the Mint, Key to the Kingdom, Fort Marcy, and a number of Elliot's very good horses, and it was a great experience. And certainly Mr. Paul Mellon was a wonderful man to work with or work for, and it was a tremendous amount of knowledge that I was exposed to. And I will say that probably one of the great things about working with Elliot was that I got to know Preston Birch, his father, who was a kind of an advisor to Mr. Mellon, and Preston had retired and was living in Middleburg, Virginia. And I would go down every other weekend, particularly in the fall, and I would always either have luncheon or dinner with Preston, and he just shared so much knowledge of what he had seen, what he had absorbed from his father, what he had helped Elliot do, and it was a tremendous learning experience.
Talking with John Veach on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John, I know oftentimes when we're young people like that, we don't often take the time to appreciate the opportunities that we have. And you certainly had a tremendous opportunity, not just with your dad, but with Elliott Birch. Were you able to, it sounds to me like you were able to keep it all in perspective because of your background and growing up with your dad.
Well, you know, I've always been very steeped in history. As I said earlier, I was a history major in college and have been always interested in the traditions and the things that make up history. And certainly history and the traditions have a great deal to do with our sport, with the fabric of our sport. And the knowledge that I had would been prepared, and the knowledge that my father had and the knowledge that his father had always been passed down from a previous generation. And it just is a tapestry of a tremendous 200 or 300 year history of horse racing.
Were you able to attend the Hall of Fame induction of Elliott Birch in 1980?
Yes, I was.
How was that? Had to be pretty cool.
That was very, very rewarding. I mean, I certainly didn't have a lot of contribution to Elliott's success, but I certainly appreciated the things that he instilled in me and the great horses that he had to train that I was exposed to, which gave me something to work with later on in my own career.
You went out on your own in 1974. How did you know that was the right time to make the move?
Well, to be honest with you, I had been very anxious and much before that time to go out on my own because I'd been around the business and from the day I was born and felt that I was well prepared for it. But my father gave me a tremendous amount of good advice, and one of the things that he told me, he says, listen, he said, I've been very successful at this. If you want to be a horse trainer, the people are going to expect you to also have a great deal of success, and you've got to be ready when you make your debut, and don't be too anxious to come out and take on a job, because it's like everything else. You can see somebody else do it. You can be an assistant coach, football coach, assistant manager in baseball, and assistant trainer in thoroughbred racing, but until you get and have to make those decisions on your own, it is considerably different.
Was there more pressure because of who your dad was?
I never felt the pressure. And I will tell you a kind of a, it's not a funny story, but it is a story when I first got the Calumet job, and Calumet had a tremendous, as everyone knows that knows anything about racing, they are the premier racing stable in America at that time, had been, you know, since the 30s, but Calumet had a bad year the first year. I went to work for them and took over the 15th day of April. And they had the worst year from the 15th day of April until the end of the year that they had ever experienced. And I was very embarrassed about it. And Lucille Markey was never said a word to me one way or the other about the failure of the stable that year. And, of course, most of the people don't realize that in the 10 years before I had taken over the stable, except for Forward Pass, they would really hit kind of a dry spell. And the number of mares had been greatly reduced, and the racing stable had not really been in the headlines for years. But that doesn't mean that name Calumet Farm still didn't ring a bell. And I had lunch as soon as I got back to Miami with the racing stable in December with the Admiral and Ms. Markey at their estate on Lagorse Island, and I went to resign. And I told Mrs. Markey how embarrassed I was and how I felt so badly about embarrassing the stable and her with my performance. And she looked me right in the eye and she said, John, it wasn't your fault. She said, it was my fault. And I just didn't give you the horses to train. She said, but the Melvin Cinnamon, my farm manager, tells me that we'll have better horses in the next couple of years and we'll do better and not to worry about it. And then that took the burden off my shoulders.
Yeah, that would certainly do so. And boy, what an understanding person she was to be able to look past that first year and to look ahead as to what was coming down the line.
Well, she was like many of the great owners of that era. They understood the game. They knew that what it was about. They knew what it took. They knew that, luck was an important factor, and that you were going to have good luck and bad luck, and you were going to have good years and bad years. And it wasn't always due to somebody's failing. But they had the patience and certainly the money, which helped, to sustain themselves and to sustain those great traditions in racing.
What do you remember about the first time you walked on to that Calumet property?
I've been fortunate enough as a young boy with my father to visit there occasionally and look at some of the stallions and things of that nature. But when I walked on as part of that team, part of that tradition, to be part of that fabric, it was exhilarating. I really can't describe it in words, but it was just being somebody that really was going to be able to be part of something that was really something.
Do you get the opportunity to go back there much anymore?
I do not. I really have not visited there very often since I attended my resignation when Mr. Lundy took over, and I did have the opportunity to visit Aladar a couple of times and see a couple of the fillies that were in the broodmare band, but not very often, which unfortunately is something that I would have really enjoyed.
Talking with Hall of Famer John Veach here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back with the second half of the program. We'll continue with the Hall of Famer next on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. The Fasig Tipton Florida sale enters a new era on Wednesday, March 4th, when the two-year-old in training sale will be held for the first time at Gulfstream Park in Hallandale Beach, Florida. With 175 entries cataloged, buyers will find outstanding quality at a variety of price ranges. 2014 Fasig Tipton two-year-old sales graduates include Grade 1 winners Bayern.
Bayern Toast of New York, Bayern has won it! Bayern got there by a head.
Competitive Edge.
Competitive Edge makes it 2 for 2 here at the spa.
And Dortmund.
Firing line and Dortmund gonna hit it together. Dortmund's comeback.
As well as greatest stakes winning two-year-olds Blofeld and I Spent It. This year's Fasig Tipton Florida sale is an event not to be missed by any major buyer. The Under Tax Show is scheduled for Monday, March 2nd, beginning at 10 a.m., with the sale hosted on Wednesday, March 4th. Visit FasigTipton.com to download your catalog today.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair Strip's gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair Strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair Strips.
If you missed the Equine Forum, you missed a lot.
Hall of Famer Nick Zito here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And I think the horse of the year this year was rightfully so in California Chrome, because he had to go through a lot of stuff, and that's what these horses do on a Triple Crown trail. So when you get, as I call it, spring training, and when you get to a place, whether it's, you know, we're lucky enough to be in Florida, a lot of horses come from, you know, Arkansas or wherever they come from, other fairgrounds, Louisiana, they still have to do well in that, what we call spring training. You know, they have to do good. They have to get better. They have to get stronger. They have to feel that they're going to step up. And that's the whole key. But, of course, Mike, with all the stuff we're talking about, you got to have the horse.
The Equine Forum, giving you the inside track on thoroughbred racing. Saturday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m. on Sirius XM Channel 92 and always streaming live at horseracingradio.net. Thursday evenings, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, is the Briznet.com call-in show. It's your chance to call in and let the Horse Racing Radio Nation know what's on your mind. Call us at 888-966-HRRN and discuss the topics you choose in the world of thoroughbred racing. The Briznet.com call-in show every Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern on Sirius 220 and XM 206 or streaming live online at horseracingradio.net. If it happens in horse racing, it happens on HRRN.
But California Chrome shines bright in the Kentucky Derby!
What a memorable Breeders' Cup Classic. It's a race for the ages.
Here's the wire, and it's a photo finish that goes to Toneland.
Wise Dan gets his head in front. The first million-dollar race in Keeneland history.
Racing's biggest events are right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. HRRN's newest show is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Every Tuesday, Mike Penna and Christina McManigal will bring you exclusive interviews with the best jockeys in the business. Tune in on our website for a new episode every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, exclusively on horseracingradio.net.
This is trainer Chad Brown, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
They're into the turn. It's Raymond Earl on top five. Ali Dar is second. Go Forth holds third. Chop Chop Tomahawk now fourth. Special Honor is fifth. Moving further stretch, Ali Dar to the outside. He moves by very easily, takes over the lead, opens it out to 3.5 lengths. Raymond Earl still holds second. Go Forth is third. Sonny Songster is making a late run on the outside. We have a furlong to run, and Ali Dar has opened the lead out to 6 lengths. Raymond Earl still second, followed on the outside by Go Forth and Sonny Songster. But as they're nearing the finish, it's Ali Dar just drawing away with the lead with every stride under the wire. Ali Dar very easy, maybe a 10-length winner.
Little trip down memory lane here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Ali Dar taking the 1978 Bluegrass Stakes. Mike Battaglia with the call. And, of course, Ali Dar would go on to finish second to his rival Affirmed in all three legs of the Triple Crown. John Veach continuing our visit here on Trainer Talk tonight. And, John, I can only imagine what's going through your mind when you hear that race call.
Well, it was great memories. I mean, that, you know, when you get the opportunity, and most trainers only once in a lifetime, and I've been very fortunate to have some very, very great horses that overcame my inabilities that gave me some great thrills. But being associated with a horse like Ali Dar is a just a thing of joy.
Yeah, and that was a very significant performance as well. Not only did he win by 10, but he raced right here in the Bluegrass at Lexington at Keeneland. And you said that turned out to be very, very significant.
Well, it was. You know, as I told you earlier, Mike, that the Admiral Ms. Markey, who were advanced in age and weren't getting around very well, had lost a lot of their mobility. And I had really thought that the Wood Memorial in New York was a better prep from a standpoint of just the time frame, 2 weeks instead of 9 days before the Derby. But I knew what the Bluegrass meant to Ms. Markey. I knew what Kentucky meant to Ms. Markey, and I knew what Calumet meant to Kentucky. And so the die was cast there, and it did give the Admiral and Ms. Markey, for the last time in their lives, a chance to see one of their great champions perform in person.
Were you feeling pretty good after the Bluegrass? He wins by 10-plus lengths, and you're thinking, boy, we got something here. And then you go into the Derby, and here comes Affirmed, and you think you got him, and he holds you off.
Yes, it was disappointing. I will tell you that. Something that happened in the running of the Derby, and I don't think it was significant in the outcome of the race, but I think that Aladar certainly would have been closer to Affirmed to finish, was that Aladar got hit in the eye at some time during the running of the race, and by the time we got him back to the barn, his eye had swollen shut. And I was concerned about it, but there was no damage done. It was just a clot of dirt or something that hit him in the face. And I explained that to Mrs. Markey that evening, And she said, she asked me, had I told anybody, particularly in the press? And I said, no, ma'am, I haven't talked to anybody about it except the veterinarian who's examined him and myself and now you. And she said, well, she said, we at Calumet don't make excuses. So she said, just that's between us, and we'll just go on to the next race. And at no time during Aladar's career was there ever any question about us finding a softer spot or going someplace else. We were going to go to the Preakness, and we were going to go to the Derby, to the Belmont, and we were going to go to the Traverse. So just to show you what type of sport she was.
How about that Preakness Stakes? What was that time like in between the Derby and the Preakness for Aladar?
Well, it was good for Aladar because he didn't realize what was happening, but it was awfully tough on John Veach because he was trying to figure out a way that I could beat a firm.
Why was obviously he was a tough rival, but what made a firm so hard to get past?
Well, I think that see, I had always, from the very beginning with Aladar, had been very conscious of his pedigree, particularly the Raisin Native side of him, who was a brilliant sprinter through a very brief career showed a great deal of speed, and many of his offsprings showed the same thing. And I was concerned that if I did too much with him from a standpoint of speed, that I would turn him into a sprinter, and he would have been a world-class sprinter. But that's not what we wanted. We wanted a Derby horse. We wanted a horse that could get a distance of ground and go a mile and a quarter. And so I worked on Aladar as kind of a one-run horse, having that last kick. And, of course, a firm was multidimensional. He could do almost anything. And when you get involved in a street fight with a horse like a firm, and he gets the first punch in, by that I mean getting a better position, it's awfully tough to bring the fight to him later on.
How frustrating was it for John Veach in those three races not to be able to get past?
It was frustrating and very disappointing, and particularly the Belmont, where I thought we had him beat at the 16th pole, and he came back on us, and Jorge Velasquez, Aladar's rider, just rode a brilliant race, and he had a firm down on the fence. And I had noticed in Steve Cawthon's career that he used his right hand with his whip more than his left hand. And because Aladar was squeezing a firm, or was so close to a firm, that Stevie couldn't go to his right and had to use his left hand. And I think when he hit a firm with his left hand, it startled him and gave him that last push at the wire.
Well, everybody always talks about the heart of a firm because he never did let Aladar by. But I've always argued that Aladar's heart, and especially what you just stated about his pedigree and everything you had to do to get him to run this far, his heart was equally as big as affirmed.
Well, they were two very great horses, and they did a great deal of good for our sport.
I can imagine then that, you mentioned you haven't returned to Calumet since tendering your resignation. I can imagine how difficult it had to be to watch what would happen later on in the 1990s, the horrific death of Aladar, and then the investigations into President J.T. Lundy. That had to be a very difficult period for you.
It was, because Calumet meant so much to me. It was my first. It was my first love. Let's say that from a standpoint, and my first taste of real success. And it just was so important to me from a personal standpoint. And to have been part of that, and to have been at least part of the, as they say, the comeback of Calumet Farm, and it was heartbreaking to see the demise.
Yeah, most of the memorabilia, the trophies, and even the famed Devil's Red and Blue Silks have all been sold, and I'm sure that for everything that Calumet meant to you, John, that couldn't have been easy for you to watch either.
No, it was not. It was, as I said, heartbreaking, I thought it was kind of a black eye to the sport for something that great to come to such a demise.
Well, Aladar was not the only outstanding racehorse you had the opportunity to be around. Let's talk about some of the champions, and we'll start with your first one. That's R. Mims, the 1977 champion three-year-old filly. Tell me about her.
Oh, she was great. She really was the, and I realized very early on in her career that the farther they went from a standpoint of distance, the better she was going to be. And kind of I mapped out a career or a campaign for her in her three-year-old year. And as we got to the new Philly Triple Crown in New York and the Coaching Club American Oaks, and I was concerned that at a mile and a half was a very, very difficult assignment for a horse that had never gone more than a mile and an eighth. And, you know, they talk about two-year-old colts going a mile and a quarter in the Derby. Well, going a mile and a half for three-year-old fillies that have never had the opportunity to run more than a mile and an eighth is difficult. And so I kind of mapped out a training schedule for her, and I basically one of her final and most important works getting ready for that mile and a half work was a mile and a half workout in the morning. And it worked perfectly, and then she won the Coaching Club American Oaks, and I'm walking out of the grandstand one morning after the race is over, and Mr. John Gaver, who is the Hall of Fame trainer and had trained for the Green Tree Stables for decades, he came over to me, and he said, you did a wonderful training job with that filly. She was the most prepared horse in the race, and he said, I just really wanted to compliment you. And those types of meetings, those types of exchanges really mean a lot to somebody makes this their career.
That style of training, John, is so old school. We don't see trainers working horses that far anymore. It just doesn't happen all that often unless you look at some old school trainers that were brought up doing things that way. And I'll give you an example. Last week I was in Florida and I caught up with the legendary Alan Jerkins, and the chief was telling me that today, you see a lot of 5/8 works and half mile works, but you don't see any of the longer works that you were accustomed to doing with your horses and he was accustomed to doing and still does to this day. He said it's almost like it's against the law to work a horse more than 5/8 today. You agree?
I do. And the thing about it is I think that a lot of trainers are hesitant to do it because if it doesn't work out, then they're into or can experience a lot of criticism, and they really don't want to go on that ground. But I've always felt that that the work you do in the morning is what you're going to see in the afternoon. And to prepare a horse, particularly to go a distance of ground, it is very beneficial or almost essential that you give them a taste of that in the morning.
The next year after our Mims comes another pretty darn good three-year-old filly. She was voted champion in 1978, and that's Devona Dale. Tell me about her.
Best horse I ever trained.
From really?
A standpoint of just pure physical ability. She could do anything. She could win at 5 furlongs or at a mile and a half. She won more consecutive graded stakes than any other horse in Calumet's history, except for the Great Citation, just to show you how good she was. She basically just... Well, she overcame me.
How so? Did you feel like that these horses were just so good? I mean, you were a tremendous trainer, John. Let's face it, Hall of Famer. All the accolades that you've received are very well deserved. But you've said that a couple of times now, that these horses overcame me. You never looked at yourself as that great trainer.
No, I had great teachers. I will never be, if I live to be 100 years old, as good a horseman as my father was. I think mainly because more was expected of him as a horse trainer, and they didn't have all of the assets that modern trainers have. I want to say veterinary medicine and things like that have progressed tremendously. So they had to be great horsemen, and they didn't run to the veterinarian every time that they had a little problem or they saw something they didn't like. They figured it out on their own. And of course, I benefited from my father's experience, and that from Elliot and Elliot's father, Preston Birch. So, it's different now.
What's your favorite Devona Dale memory?
I think that I would have to say that she is the only filly that ever was able to win both the old Philly Triple Crown, the Oaks in Kentucky, the Black Eyed Susan, and the Coaching Club American Oaks in New York, and then the modern New York Racing Association, the Acorn, the Mother Goose, and the Coaching Club American Oaks. you know, that was a tremendous, tremendous accomplishment on her part.
I used to love that Triple Crown, and so much is made of the Triple Crown with the males, and rightfully so, but that New York Triple Crown, and for me growing up just an hour from Saratoga, that's what I became familiar with, John. That was very difficult to achieve, and if you had a filly that could pull it off, it was a very, very special feat.
Oh, yes, yes. It took a very special filly to be able to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when you look at the mile Acorn, the mile and an eighth Mother Goose, and then the mile, and it, as it was then, the mile and a half Coaching Club American Oaks, that is a very, very difficult assignment. And also, it takes, and I'm not saying this because I did that, but it takes a pretty good horseman to be able to keep a horse to accomplish those three distances in a short, you know, time plane.
A couple of years later, actually 3 years later, you welcomed in the two-year-old filly champion to your barn, and that was Before Dawn. Tell me about her.
I'm going to tell you a funny story about her, Mike. She was very small. She was very nervous. She was a very, very bad stall walker. And for somebody that's not familiar with that term, is that she would basically go to the back of her stall, turn in a corner, run to the front of the stall, turn in the opposite corner, and do that repeatedly all day long. And that year we didn't have a three-year-old colt that we were pointing toward the Derby, so we went to Payson Park for the winter training period. And I guess in April, when I'm starting to prepare to go back to New York with the racing stable, I called Melvin Cinnamon, the Calumet farm manager, and I said, Melvin, I said, this filly just has not shown anything. And I said, she's small, she's a terrible stall walker. I just don't think that she's worth taking to New York, and I think that maybe, you know, I'll send her back to the farm, and in the fall you can think about making her a broodmare or selling her to somebody else, because she does have a little pedigree. And he said, well, he said, have you tried everything? I said, Melvin, I put a goat in with her, drove the goat crazy. I put mirrors in her stall. She never looked at them. I said, we put a radio in the stall. She never listened. We put a TV in front of the stall, and she never watched. So he said, well, just take her to New York and fool with her. You've got plenty of space up there. And I said, I do. And so I took her up to New York, and I sent a group of two-year-old fillies over to the starting gate one morning just to school them a little bit more, and broke them out of the starting gate, and it was like turning a light on in a dark room. And she won race after race after race and became a two-year-old filly, and I was willing to give her away in April. Something overcame me.
Yeah, you just never know. We see that all the time in this sport where there's horses that people write off very earlier in their career. Many times they write them off at the horse sales because something doesn't look good in the repository or whatever it might be. And John, that's about the biggest mistake that anybody could make.
Oh, sure. I will tell you from experience, when I first went to work for Elliot Birch, and I'm having lunch with Preston, his father, and we're talking about the horses that he trained. He trained Sword Dancer. Preston Birch trained Sword Dancer as a two-year-old. And Sword Dancer made numerous starts as a two-year-old and just never really showed anything. But Preston saw something that was there. And instead of culling him out at the end of the year, he retired and became the general manager, and Elliot became the trainer, and lo and behold, Sword Dancer's Horse of the Year the following year is a three-year-old.
Unbelievable. This is the greatest sport in the world. Talking with John Veach here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. All right, 7 years later, you know where I'm going with this one. You welcome in a champion turf male, and that's Sunshine Forever, and boy, what a horse. This horse was incredible.
He was incredible. He was. Then the key to him was Mr. Galbraith's patience. I looked at his pedigree. I saw him every day as a two-year-old. I realized that his future was going to be on the grass and that he was not going to be able to show us very much as a two-year-old. And I just went to Mr. Galbraith and I said, we may have something here. He's not going to show as much this year, but I think he's going to be worth the investment and the patience. And he said, I agree with you. And he said, you do what you think is best. So we gave him a very light two-year-old year, but as a three-year-old, he came on as gangbusters, and he was magnificent.
John Veach on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton, the trainer of four champions. Of course, he also trained Ali Dar, who was runner-up in all three legs of the 1978 Triple Crown. And, John, you must hate hearing that, don't you?
No, you know, to be honest with you, I was very disappointed when it happened. It broke my heart. And I, not only for myself, but I wanted so much for the Admiral and Ms. Markey because, as I said earlier, they were advanced in age, and it might have been the last really great horse that they could have seen and had of their own. But in hindsight, and as the years have gone by, I realized that you can't say affirmed without saying Aladar, and you can't say Aladar without saying affirmed. So it was a wonderful thing to be involved with. And it's part of the history of the game, which I'm so proud of.
We've talked about your relationship with Calumet, but you mentioned the name John Galbraith and talking about historic Darby Dan Farm. That was another period in your life that really, I know, meant an awful lot to you.
Oh, yes. I mean, the entire Galbraith family were wonderful. Jody and Wally Phillips, Jody being Dan Galbraith's sister and John Galbraith's daughter, and the Phillips family. And certainly Mr. Galbraith and the horses that they had. And I had heard before I went to work for him, it was funny because in between the time that I left Calumet and went to work for Darby Dan, and I put together what I thought was going to be a very powerful public stable. But my heart was not into being a public trainer. My heart was into being a private trainer, as my father had been. And Joe Hirsch called me up one morning, and he just basically said, John, he said, would you be interested in taking another private job? And I said, Joe, it would be if it's the right job. He said, it is. And he said, I will tell my principal, or the man that approached him, and we'll set up a meeting. And it was with Mr. Galbraith. And we sat down, and we talked numbers, and we talked horses. And I said at the very end of our conversation, I said, well, I will try to run your racing stable as much as I can and as close as I can to a business. And he looked me straight in the eye, and he said, John, he said, real estate is my business. Horse racing is my sport, and you will run it as a sport.
Boy, that's tremendous. That's outstanding. John, you finally stepped away in 2003 when you officially retired. Was that a difficult decision?
No, no? It was an easy decision. I will say that only because I don't want to use the contemporary phrase that the game had passed me by, because I had done and accomplished almost everything I wanted. My father had five champions. I've only had four. I would have liked to at least tied him. I'd done everything, and I thought I would just wanted to move on and see what else I could do for the industry and in the industry.
Well, you held the position as the chief state steward of the Kentucky Horse Racing Board or Horse Racing Commission, however you want to look at it, and everything was going along according to plan until the 2010 Breeders' Cup at Churchill, when you came under fire for the poor performance of the Todd Pletcher-trained Life at 10, and the way that situation was handled, you were eventually relieved of your duties, and then after a lengthy battle to clear your name, it was recently announced by a judge that you were indeed wrongly dismissed. That had to be a huge relief, and that had to be hell for you over the past few years.
It has been a very difficult time, not only on myself, but it has been very, very difficult on my wife. And it was something that never should have happened. They could have fired me for any reason, and that would have been fine. But then to take the action that they deemed appropriate was not appropriate. And I don't think it cast a very good light on the Racing Commission, how they handled it. But that is. But again, it's not over yet because we're back in court. So.
Yeah, it doesn't end, does it?
No.
Finish this sentence for me, John. I'll put you on the spot here for a moment. When I stop and look back on my career, the one thing I'm most proud of is.
I think I'm most proud of the job that I did preparing Proud Truth for to win the Breeders' Cup Classic. I ran Proud Truth in the Kentucky Derby, and he ran a credible race, but he was not 1-2-3. I decided that the Preakness should be skipped, and we would point to the Belmont. And I wanted to use the Peter Pan as a prep, which he won very handily. He came out of the Peter Pan with a saucer fracture in his cannon bone. He was off the entire summer. I got him back about the 1st of September under training, and I did, for the first time in my entire career, instead of planning up to a race, I planned from the race back. So I took the day of the Breeders' Cup, and I went day by day what I was going to do with him from that day to the 1st of September, every workout, every gallop, every prep race, and of course, I had the horse that I could do that with, and everything worked out, and it just was like blocks or dominoes falling one after the other. He just did everything in succession that I expected, and everything worked out well, and he won the Breeders' Cup Classic.
Yeah, you keep talking about horses overcoming you. I think this was much the opposite. You're far too humble, my friend.
Well, you know, but it did work out. You know, I had a race picked out and a major prep race for the Breeders' Cup Classic at Aqueduct, which is always an important factor to get a race over the racetrack, was a stake race 7 days before the Breeders' Cup. And I ran him in that, and he did win, not convincingly, but it was a win, and then he came back in the Breeders' Cup Classic and ran the race of his life.
Visiting with Hall of Famer John Veach on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. John, you had your dad and Elliot Birch take you under their wing. Have you developed that type of relationship at any point in your career with a young trainer who came to you looking for advice?
Well, I mean, I've had, I want to say hundreds of young trainers or would-be trainers, you know, that even to this day that call up and ask advice or guidance, which I'm very happy to give. But I will tell you that so much of my success and the horses that I trained that were successful was not just my input, but I had some of the greatest people working with me. I had a man by the name of Clyde Sparks and Jesse Spots, two black men from Kentucky that were grooms, and Clyde rubbed horses, actually galloped horses for my father at the Whitney Farm before World War II, came out of the Army, became a groom, rubbed a horse for my father called Fisherman, the first American horse to win the Washington, D.C. International, went on to be the groom for Aladar, for me. Jesse Spots had our Mims and Devona Dale. Frank Rose, Charlie Rose, was one of my first assistants and rode both Aladar and our Mims. Just tremendous people are the unsung heroes of our sport.
Yeah, so many of those stories out there, and it's great that you take the time to recognize them, because I know every trainer would tell you the same thing. What does the future hold for John Veach?
I don't know. I still work for Keeneland a little bit and work for Turfway a little bit, and it gives me something to do, and I try to keep up with the sport. I would certainly like to contribute as much as I possibly can, because it's been my life, and it's been a good life. And it was a good life for my father and for my grandfather, and I hope it is going to be a good life for the coming generations of horsemen, wherever they are. And it's a wonderful thing to be involved with.
John, only a minute or two left to wrap up this Trainer Talk edition. It's been just an amazing hour to hear your story and talk about this with you. But what other things outside of horse racing is John Veach interested in? Football?
Oh, no. No, that's long past. You know, I probably my main vocation right now, I love to read. I'm still deeply involved in reading, particularly American history and world history, and it's amazing that how much you can learn from it. And I certainly wish that some of our current day politicians would read a little history and realize some of the decisions that they're making have been made in the past and have not worked out quite as well as they expected.
Now, those who do not learn from history are destined to repeat it, right?
That is correct.
John Veach here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton. John, again, such a delight, and I want to wish you all the best moving forward. I can't wait to see you at Keeneland here in the spring and maybe even up at Turfway here in the winter. I know you're there, so I will make sure I do that. And again, thanks so much for being here. You've always handled yourself with absolute class through all of the ups and downs, the turmoil, whatever might come along in your personal life. Nobody would ever say that John Veach is not a class act.
Well, Mike, thank you very much. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you, my friend. John Veach here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton. Wow. I didn't even want to ask questions. I wanted him just to keep talking for the full hour and just keep telling stories. So much that John Veach can tell about this sport. So many unbelievable moments and so many. He's part of the lore. He's part of the mystique that is thoroughbred racing. Tremendous. My thanks to John Veach for taking the time here tonight. Don't forget, tomorrow night, the Brisnet.com call-in show comes your way. And, of course, on Friday night, our Express Bet weekend stakes previews. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penna. We will talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton.